If you want your vegetables to have a genuine zest for life, then Joseph Lofthouse's book, Landrace Gardening, is for you. Here's what readers are saying. A short, inspiring, informative read that blew my mind at least once per chapter. Everything is far more productive and delicious than ever before. The best book I've read on gardening in ages. Get your copy of Landrace Gardening now, and start growing locally adapted varieties. Welcome to the Going to Seed podcast. I'm your host, Shane Simonson, and today we have Austin Vaughan, who is doing all sorts of incredible landrace gardening experiments in the challenging climate of Texas. So to get us started, Austin, can you tell us a bit about your background and the path that led you to crop breeding?
Yes. So basically, my background is that when I was growing up, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't have enough diversity of experience to really, dabble in a bunch of different things. So I kind of just wandered and, I went to college and I didn't know what I wanted to do then. And I went into business and I graduated at Mississippi State University, with a bachelor degree in business. But, I really wish that I would have had more experience, and just in general things to know what I was passionate about before, I did all that. So, but then I found myself as a sales rep for a lawnmower parts distributor. So now that's what I do now. I've been doing that for about 7 years. And so I just basically travel 3 different states, and I visit different companies that buy parts from us and I promote our company, and that's kind of what I do. So, but yeah, in terms of how I found myself getting into gardening and landrace, breeding, around COVID time, around 2021, there was a time where it was hard to get gas, and I do a lot of traveling, and, and there was a point where, I was at a gas station and just about every single pump, was completely, the whole gas station in terms of the 2 cheaper varieties of gas were completely out. All they had left was like the most expensive premium type gas available, and I know that, tractors, use gas, and they're the reasons why, one farmer can feed 1,000 people. And I was thinking, this is a crazy world we live in. It's time for me to learn how to grow my own food. And I lost trust in the system the way it is now. So that's what got me into gardening, or at least opened my mind up to to being willing to try new things. And my grandpa, I respect him a lot, and he convinced me to, start gardening, and that's how I got started.
Brilliant, brilliant. So now this is the part I'm really interested in. Can you tell us about your local growing conditions? Because you're dealing with some really interesting challenges.
So I've looked at my weather for this year, and I've wrote it down. And so far, since the January 1st, we've had 6 days that were below, 32 degrees or below. And 5 of those days were in January. And we had 1 day last month that was 32 or below. And our last frost was February 19th. So we haven't had any kind of temperature below 32 degrees Fahrenheit since that day. So, I've been planting a lot of things, and, just in case it didn't frost again. And it looks like we might have an early spring. I hope so, because every year, we usually have a fall spring where you think it's spring, but it's not. And then you get a frost and it ruins everything. Last 3 or 4 years, it's been that way for me. But I have my fingers crossed and hope that this is a real early spring. If that's the case, then that's almost a month early, because usually my last frost is around the middle of March, around the 5th. So that would be quite incredible to get that early start.
Is that an extra advantage of saving your own seed, that it's not so big a deal if you lose your spring seedlings? You just sow them again because you've got so much seed on hand?
But yeah, where I live at is pretty much the same climate. David the Good, I don't know if you've ever watched his YouTube.
Yeah.
It's the exact same climate. North to south, we're identical. It's just east of me about maybe 80, 100 miles or something like that. The same climate. So, it really pays to take risk around here, because you never know, when the last frost is really going to be. So just, I like to plan extra seeds in advance. It's worth it to me because if I can buy myself an extra 3 or 4 weeks in the first part of the season, that would be great because it won't be long before the temperatures are going to be so crazy. It's going to be, 100 degrees, before we know it. And it's going to be really difficult to get certain plants to produce fruit. So just trying to get as early as I can.
Do you mostly do direct sowing?
Yeah, mostly. Probably, 90% of what I do is direct sowing, but I do some transplanting, after I start in, like pots or seed trays.
What about your soil? You have a pretty interesting soil from what I've seen.
I think it's probably about 75% clay and maybe 10% sand, and the rest of the amount would probably be silt, but it's largely clay. And when I the way my clay responds is when it starts to rain a lot, it softens up quite a bit. So I do a land raise, I call it carrot and clay land raise, and it rains so much where I live that even though my soil is predominantly clay, when it rains over here, at least in my climate, it softens up quite a bit. And if someone's in an environment like I get about 6 inches of rain per year, if someone's in a different climate where they get 10 inches of rain a year, I can imagine their experience, even though the ratio of clay to sand is the same, I can imagine their experience be much different. Because last year we did go through a drought, and I noticed how hard that stuff can really get. It's just really, really hard. But as long as I'm getting, consistent rainfall, that stuff's just great to grow in.
And do you do any irrigation or are you relying on rainfall?
I try to rely on rainfall in my pumpkin patch and watermelon patch, but I do have a sprinkler system over in my main garden. I just recently started doing that, and last year I didn't do any sort of irrigation other than trying to get seeds started and try to keep things alive when it gets really hot.
And are you importing fertility? Do you rely on any extra fertility?
Well, I just recently got a big jug of fish fertilizer, so I'm going to be experimenting with that. In the past, when I first started, I got a lot of bags of like composted cow manure you can get like at a hardware store. And I tried that out, and fortunately, I think I got lucky at it. I got the bags that didn't have, that really bad chemicals in it that could ruin your garden. Apparently, I got lucky. But after that first year, I really haven't really imported a whole lot of types of amendments and things to my garden. At one point, I added some rock dust in there and to try to add some minerals and stuff in it. But for the most part, it's just the natural dirt that's out there.
It's one of the advantages of most clays that they're quite mineral rich, that you have the texture to deal with, but at least, I mean, if you've got pure sand, you can have a real mineral issue if you're unlucky. So, yeah, it sounds like you've got some advantages there. What about weeds and pests? What's your strategy with them?
The weeds are absolutely terrible over here. I mean, it's like every weekend, I get home and I probably spend 2 or 3 hours a weekend just weeding. It's insane. And it's just a nonstop thing. I think I'm probably and responsible for half of the seeds that the weed seeds that get in my garden begin with, just the practices that I do. Because sometimes I'll get a compost pile and full of grass clippings and who knows what else in there, and I don't really turn over my compost pile very much. I know it's not really a hot compost. It's really halfway done, and I throw grass clippings and that haven't even been composted out there in the garden, and half composted material that's full of weed seeds, and I'm responsible for putting those in there too. I'm kind of just rethinking how I'm doing things, because the amount of weeds that are been coming up in my garden is absolutely ridiculous. But I'm learning as I go and trying new things as I go, and from there.
Couple of things that reminds me of Steve Solomon, I think. I don't know if you've read any of his books. says that the best indication of a place that's worth growing vegetables is that it's capable of growing a healthy crop of weeds. Like, you want to see the weeds getting up to shoulder height in the land that you're thinking about growing vegetables on, because otherwise it's probably not naturally fertile enough. You'll have an uphill battle on that side. And I also remember seeing a survey in the 1800s in the United States of the amount of weeds on farms, and pretty much all of them were infested with weeds. So my approach is that as long as you get the weeds out of the way enough to let the crop claim its space, that's all you have to do. You don't have to eliminate them. It's just a tipping the balance kind of issue.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's that.
One thing you might find useful that I do, because we're in similar climates, when it gets really hot and things are growing really, really fast, rather than trying to get the roots out of the weeds out of the roots, I get a little hand sickle, a little serrated hand sickle. And if I see the weeds are starting to get close to producing seed, and then you end up with like a carpet of seedlings next season when you're trying to get your crops to germinate, I'll just cut the tops off and then put them straight onto the bed as kind of a green manure and leave the roots in place. And it's surprising how many weeds, if you do that a couple of times, they just kind of give up on life. They're not used to being structurally messed around with that much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is something I thought about too, is that the modern weeds, I think, are just absolutely vicious, because I think they're in some ways we've adapted weeds to make them even worse than they used to be because of the modern lawnmower.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certain weeds have learned that they have to go from nothing to something extremely fast. You know, some weeds you cut down with a lawnmower, and then by the time you crank up your lawnmower again a week or two later, it's already almost ready to go to flower. So some, you know, the ones that have survived, you know, are capable of reproducing at this point, even though they're mowed so frequently, are the ones that have learned that they need to get busy fast.
Well,
I
have a similar strategy along those lines. I look at the species of weeds in my vegetable garden, and the ones that are the best behaved and the easiest to manage, I actually let them go to seed and I spread them around, because that way they can help me elbow out the ones that are a real nightmare when they get established. So not all weeds are created equal, and some of them can actually be a benefit.
Yeah, that's true.
What about pests? Because you've got some, well, I read about the kind of pests that you have to deal with in the US, and you've got some nasty ones and some new ones too.
The first year I had a really bad problem with the cabbage lopper. And ever since then, I've been anticipating it, but it's never came back, you know. And then the second year I started gardening, I had real big issues with stink bugs and the leaf-footed bug, which is, I think, is like a relative of the stink bug. And so those are the two main. And then the third year, it was basically the same thing as the second. It was mostly the leaf footer and the stink bug. And I've got, you know, really good diversity of insects. The area that I live in is actually, and to put it into where, like, a city that people would recognize, the closest main city to where I live is Mobile, Alabama. And they, in this area, between, you know, where I live and Mobile, Alabama, there's a lot of nurseries. Like, this is a really good area for nurseries for whatever reason. And so I think that probably helps me, because there's so many different, you know, flowers in the area. I think we have a good native bee population and just other pollinators in general. That's really not a limiting factor for me. There's a lot of insects. So that's not a problem at all.
Well, if you're doing Grexing, you're probably like naturally selecting for pest resistance, whether you even notice the difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the second year, last year, what I did was is I had a bed dedicated in the middle of my garden, dedicated just for wildflowers, and I planted a bunch of wildflowers out there, and I think that helped out too. Mm-hmm. And so this year, I've put a bird bath out there in the middle of my garden, and I hope that's going to not only, you know, keep the birds watered, but also insects too. So I'm going to be growing a lot of tomatoes, and hopefully I've read that sometimes birds will go into your fruits more often if they're thirsty. So if at least I can eliminate the thirst aspect of things, then maybe they wouldn't be inclined to puncture holes in my tomatoes quite as often otherwise, but we'll see. I think,
Yeah, sorry, you go.
okay, yeah, I think that the main thing is for me is getting enough to where I'm at. Like I, for example, I've got about 40 different spots where I'm planting the Cucurbita machata. My family and I, we really don't. I'd be happy with 10 pumpkins or 10 squash. There's only so many that you really want to eat to begin with. So I'm planting significantly more than I want. So I'm hoping to be able to save seeds from those that do well regardless. I'm not really applying any kind of insecticides or anything like that. So hoping that in the future I could continue improving, the pest resistance that the plants can do for themselves.
If you're growing that many pumpkins, consider learning how to eat the seeds, like drying and toasting them, and maybe grinding them for people who don't want to chew on them whole. They're so nutritious and it's so overlooked.
The I think seeds they can potentially offer us a lot because everything that the plant needs for the first 2 or 3 weeks of its life is retained in just a single seed.
So, what are your broad priorities in crop breeding? Like, what are you trying to aim towards?
Main thing is I want to be able to just put some seeds in the ground and then they just do the rest. I know that sounds like a lofty dream to be able to just put a seed in the ground and then come back 2 or 3 months later and then collect. I almost want to be parasitic. Like you have a relationship between two different organisms. One can be mutually beneficial, another's parasitic. I'd like to be able to be just the parasitic type that I don't have to provide fertilizer. I don't have to provide pesticide. I don't have to do any kind of weeding. I'd rather just rely like 100% on the plant to do pretty much everything. So that would be my goal, to just to be as lazy as possible.
I really like that, but don't sell yourself short. Like, look at how many relationships between plants and animals, where the plant s supports the animal, like produces fruit, and all the animal has to do is eat the fruit and move it. Like, that's what that the plant can't do that for itself. So if you're harvesting seeds, keeping them safe and dry, and then putting them back in the ground at the right time, you're doing something valuable for the plant. So yeah, I think that's a wonderful aim.
Yeah.
Now, let's jump into your specific crop breeding projects because I know you've got quite a few. So, which one do you want to tell us about first?
Okay, so there's a number of different things that I'm doing. So I've kind of broken it down in terms of like categories. So I'm growing roots, growing onions, which I think are called alliums, if I'm pronouncing that right, or
Oh,
probably not.
allium, allium.
Okay. Yeah, I'm doing roots and the alliums and then cucurbits, nightshade fruits. I'm doing brassicas and the miscellaneous. So, in the miscellaneous is going to be corn, fava beans, and okra. And I'm doing those. The corn for the first time ever. I've never grown corn before, but it seems like everyone's interested in growing corn. Everyone's interested in talking about growing corn, and everyone loves to eat corn. So I guess it's time for me to get into the corn game and see what I can do. But yeah, fava beans. This is the first year I've ever grown fava beans. I'm really excited about that because the potential to grow beans in the cold part of the year is very attractive to me because there's not a lot of competition in the cold period. There's not a lot of things that I like to actually eat and grow in that in the cold time, and be able to do beans is great because we eat beans all the time. Okra, I absolutely love the way raw okra taste. And I tasted that for the first time last year. Just as soon as after about 3 or 4 days after it got pollinated, and tasting that is just it's wonderful. Raw okra taste. I'm doing okra as well. But yeah, there's in terms of the nightshade fruits. Reason why I say nightshade fruits because I read yesterday that radish is a nightshade. I don't know if that's true, but I read it, and so, but I've
It's a
got
brassica.
it's a brassica. Okay,
Yeah.
so yeah, in the nightshade fruit section, I've got sweet peppers and ground cherry and tomato, and in the brassica section, I've got cabbage and Brussels sprouts. And the root section, I've got turnips, beets, radish, parsnip, carrot, and root parsley. And then the alliums, I've got bulb onions, which are short days for me, bunching onions, and leeks. And the cucurbits, I've got the cucurbita machata, cucumber, muskmelon, and watermelon. So I know that's quite a bit of a, a list of different crops for someone to grow, in their backyard. So I'm just kind of just getting my feet wet and planting a bunch of different kind of plants and trying to learn and go from there. But eventually I'm going to have to shorten this list down. I don't think I'm going to make a serious amount of progress, in all these. Eventually I'm going to have to cut down some of them.
But that's a perfect strategy because every block of land that you try growing on, some varieties will just love it and be really easy, and other ones, no matter what you do, will always be a struggle. And the only way to find that out is to put them in the ground and watch them for a few years. And even then, like they might do really well one year because it was an unusual year. And then every year after that, that's a more typical year, they'll struggle. So it takes time to figure out what a particular block of land wants to do.
And it's kind of been a surprise for a lot of people, especially where I live, about carrots, because never even, I don't think I've actually talked to somebody in real life, and I've talked to a lot of people about gardening that actually has success growing carrots where I live. Like it's almost, even my grandfather who's 78 years old and has been gardening since before I was born. I mean, she's probably been gardening for about 50, actually when he was just a kid, because back in those days, I think he was like almost like a basically a sharecropper. I mean, we come from nothing. You couldn't even scratch two pennies together back in Mississippi, where I live, currently live. So, I mean, 50 years ago, things were a lot harder than they are now. And even see, if he's 78, I bet he's been gardening for 70 years because he probably started when he was just a little boy. And so, and he's never, and I think it was just kind of a stroke of luck. And I think too, probably is that when I prepared the ground, I wasn't doing it in this huge field like he does, with tractors and that sort of thing. When I got a bed ready, I just made sure that everything was cared for, and the ground was really soft and pulverized. And even though I was growing in clay, I softened up quite a bit, took a lot of what we called elbow grease, a shovel and a hoe. That's one
It's
of the.
interesting when you run a tractor over a piece of land, it'll often fluff up like the top 6 inches, but it's compacting the land below that. So every time you think you're improving the soil, you're actually making it worse in a way that is almost invisible, but the plants can tell. I mean, even a small plant will send roots down a meter if it can, or it'll stop at 6 inches if it hits a clay pan that you've created a compaction area. How did you source your original material for growing carrots?
First year is I actually used quite a bit of that the manure that I bought, the bag manure. I think it was cow manure that I had used that was compost already, that you can just get it, any hardware store. I kind of what I did was is I blended it 50-50 with the native soil, and I also used some it's that white stuff that you see in potting mixes. I think it's like a vermiculite or perlite, one of the, I think it's the perlite is the white pearl for like white is white pearl, I think. Pearl, yeah. I used a whole big bag of perlite, and I kind of mixed it into the native soil. And the guy that I bought it from in the nursery, he asked me like, you're gonna put this in your soil, and I'm like, yeah, it's just I'm okay with doing weird, I do weird stuff all the time. But yeah, I put that in the soil and, with some compost, and that's all I did. And that's how the first year got started. And second year, I did it, with whatever was left over with the fertility that I had already started in the third year. So I've done it for 3 years now, and carrots is one of those things where I've never failed to grow a crop of carrots. It's just always worked out for me. I guess I've got something soul that they like.
Did you start with a wide range of genetics? Like, did you try different varieties of carrots?
No, actually, the first year was before I discovered landrace gardening, and I just grabbed a 75-cent packet of Danvers 126 carrots at the co-op, and I just went with that, and it worked out. But one part of my carrot strategy that I think that I do that probably other people don't do is that I plant a significant amount of quantity. Like if it, I figured out that you can, there are certain places like you can get carrot seeds that are super cheap. You know, I can get, you know, if I go to a certain places, I can buy like carrots that you can get them. You can get probably 4 or 5,000 carrot seeds for under $1 at the right places. And you know, planting significant quantities of carrots. So, you know, it's just the law of averages and numbers. You know, when you have significant quantity of seeds in the ground, despite all things that can go wrong, you'll have success. So,
have you noticed any changes in the way they grow from the seeds that you've saved yourself?
Well, actually, I've never achieved a carrot that actually went to seed and produced seed. So, fortunate for me, I haven't actually got to that point yet, despite, you know, trying several times. So hopefully, you know, I looked out there this morning and I do have one bed that looks like one of those carrot plants are producing a seed stalk. So it's about 2 to 3 times longer in height than all the other carrots.
Yeah.
And so no flowers yet, but I do hope, you know, with my fingers crossed that it will turn into a flower soon.
So what's the barrier to getting them to complete their life cycle for your particular climate? Is it too hot in the summer? Or because I know if I try and grow carrots through the summer here, they just melt. Because I'm in the subtropics, I'm like southern Florida.
Yeah, so over here, I'm beginning to suspect that it has to do with the amount of chill hours. I guess that's more of like a fruit tree terminology, but I think it has something to do with chill hours. Because, you know, like before, I've only had 6 days this whole year that was 32 or below. And usually when it drops down below, like 32 or below, usually it's just a few hours or maybe a day. Although in January we did have 3 days consistently that were below that, but that was probably unusual, except for January. So I think it may have something to do with chill hours. I think that probably carrots were bred, you know, in a certain way in a certain location for a long period of time. It's almost like, you know, if they're bred in the north, you know, maybe like in Wisconsin or Michigan or something like that. When you have carrots that start to go to flower early in response to, you know, a certain amount of temperature, they call those out. They say those are bad, you know, those aren't good for their breeding program. So, but for somebody like me, you know, I would love for a carrot to go, even one that's a reject for you would be, you know, my favorite one. You know, I'd love for any carrot to go to flower. That's at this point. The amount of failure rate that I've had on that.
I think it sounds like you're ready to do a variety trial. You've got to like pull in as much diversity, maybe some Grexes that other people have made that are already mixed up to save you a season and just let them go and see what they do. Because for me, I was growing carrots for many years. And in my climate, the only way I can grow them is I sow them in the autumn and then they flower in the spring. So like 6 months and they've gone to flower. Our summers are so extreme that they can't even survive that end of the year.
Yeah, so what is the hottest point that it can get for you? You know, the hottest for me last year was 106 degrees Fahrenheit, but I don't know how that converts over to Celsius. That's
that,
probably
yeah,
what
that would be in the low 40s. And yeah, we do get up into the low 40s during drought years, but the more difficult years where we get 100% humidity and 35 degrees for like 6 weeks in a row. And I think at one, at our most extreme rain we've had recently, we got a meter of rain in 3 days.
Yeah, when you that, you know, people around here, they're so used to, I guess we use the imperial system, that when you say 3 meters, I'm not even conceiving what you're talking about. I don't even know what three.
That'd be 3 feet of rain in 3 days.
Oh, okay, 3 feet of rain in 3 days. Yeah, that's quite a lot, even for here too.
Oh, Australia's pretty crazy, but it's got its upsides. So are there any other species you want to talk about? Are you doing hand pollination on any of your cucurbits or just letting them figure it out themselves?
I do a combination of both, but I don't really get bent out of shape about trying to force something to be true. You know, like if, you know, I might get lucky one weekend when I'm home and I might see that there's out of 40, you know, machadas that I've got out there, I might have 20 of them that have female flowers, and I might go out there and pluck a bunch of male flowers from random ones and go to other random ones and, you know, connect the male flowers with the females. But I'm not going to worry about, you know, messing with that female flower ahead of before it opens up and going in there and covering it up so that way it prevents it from opening, and then going getting a male flower the following morning and ensuring that it was 100% a hybrid. I do a lot of, you know, trying to promote the cross pollination, but you know, when I say seeds, it's either going to be a hybrid or it's not. I'm not really getting bent out of shape about whether or not it is or not, but I'm allowing the bees to help me out for them. And bees are doing 90% of it. I'm just trying to be the insurance program that comes in there every now and then and kind of helps out with that. So.
If you're working a full-time job, hand pollination is probably really challenging because it all comes down to timing. Like often it's like at just the right hour in the morning, you have to get out there and do like 5 seconds worth of work, but you can't do that 5 seconds worth of work at any other time in the day. So it's great for people who are retired or maybe children. Oh no, they'd be shipped off to school most of the time. So yeah, all the retirees out there, you're the people that we need out there hand pollinating, I think.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of times when it in the right time, you know, I'm not there and there's really nothing I can do about it.
Do you have any plans for particular crop species to like bring in more genetics and do a variety trial or create your own Grex population?
Yeah, pretty much everything I mentioned, I'm interested in increasing the diversity of. Probably going to lean on more of the smaller types of plants in the long run, just because I feel like I can make a bigger dent in terms of making progress in a serious way. Because, you know, our, like one example might be carrots or onions versus a machata. You know, a machata takes up an enormous amount of space, and it's a really minor crop in terms of what we eat as a family. So I'm doing it for fun, but in the long run, I think I'm probably going to be leaning much more into the smaller type plants. And it's just so much more efficient for space. You know, I can grow, if I really wanted to, I could probably grow 1,000 carrots at once and have a tremendous amount of diversity and tremendous amount of numbers. But, you know, for that same space, I could probably only do 50 machadas.
Have you tried growing your pumpkins in a small patch of fertility and then letting them run over the lawn? So you don't actually have to like prepare the whole area where they're producing?
I'm gonna do that. There's somebody in the going to seed community that's gonna send me some of David the Good's compost pumpkin seeds. I'm gonna try that. I'm gonna buy a bag of cow manure, composted cow manure, and I'm just gonna empty it out into a mound, and I'm gonna put his seeds in there, and I'm gonna see how they do. Because in his video, he produced a significant quantity of seeds from just, you know, a couple different plants. You know, it was quite amazing. I think he had at least, I would say he had at least 100 pounds from one plant, and it just came from a big compost pile. So I'm gonna do the thing.
Yeah,
We'll see what happens.
I'm starting to see that as how pumpkins work best. As long as they get enough concentrated fertility at their root, then the vines can like take on the rest of the world. And if you've got a lawn that you can, you know, mow around the plant when it's small and then let it explode as it fruits, then after the season's finished, you can get the mower back in there and tidy it up and reclaim the space. And they almost seem to prefer to grow like that.
Yeah, I suspect that myself, because last year I had a couple plants that produced in a high fertility area before I could get to it, and they just volunteered and produced, you know, 6 or 7 fruits, and I didn't have to do any work other than just staying away from it for a period of time.
Yep, that's it. That's it. That's the goal. Let's get into the bonus round. So, if you could like wave a magic wand and like create a whole new crop or transform something in some magical way, what would you create?
Yeah, I put some thought into this one. And I think probably what I'd want to do is produce a muscadine bush. So maybe I'm just guessing there's a lot of people that haven't heard of muscadine because it's more of like a South US type plant. It's basically a southern grape that's delicious. And I'd love to be able to have a like a bush that gets maybe 2 or 3 feet in height. Sort of like a ground cherry, but maybe taller and have thicker diameter limbs and stems and everything, to where it could just get loaded with muscadine grapes and be able to produce that in a low input situation.
That sounds amazing. And there's so many wild grape species in the US. I think some of them do have a bush form. So, and if I recall correctly, someone might be able to tell me otherwise on this. I'm pretty sure that Luther Burbank, that was one of his dreams, was making a bush form of a grape using some of that American genetics. So there you go. Great minds think alike. You got to get onto that.
Yeah, that's something that would be very interesting to me. Can't wait to get started.
It's really funny growing muscadine grapes here in Australia because we're in a similar climate to like Florida or Georgia without the frost. When you let people try them, they're like, that tastes like American grape lollies. So when you've got candy in the US that's grape flavored or soda, it tastes like muscadine grape. It doesn't taste anything like European grapes. It's a completely different note. And it suddenly makes sense. Like we occasionally get American lollies exported out here. And it's like, what is this flavor? It's muscadine grape. Now we know. So, what is the vision of the future of food in your community?
I think, we can just get started with more people gardening in general. I think if there's steps to this, maybe the first step is just more people producing more of their own food. And if we can just get to that point, we would be so much better off. And of course, I'd love for everyone to recognize the opportunity that's right in front of them to improve their food. This is one of the things I love about land-based gardening is that it gives you the knowledge and the awareness that you can improve the food that you eat every day. You do have that ability to make it that much easier. If it's even if I just increase the ability of my peppers to grow 10% better every single year, whether it's 10% more fruit, 10% less input, 10%. Maybe I can get started 1 week earlier and go 1 week later, whatever the thing is that you want to improve, just 10% every year for long, you have a crop that's twice as good as it was before. That's
Brilliant.
what we, yeah.
Now, how do you hope to pass your work on to future generations?
Hopefully, one of my sons or both of them will pick up on some of the things that I try to teach them and try to get them to see value in and hopefully I'll make a dent somewhere, and maybe I would have said something to somebody that caused them to start gardening, just like my grandpa convinced me to garden, maybe there'd be a few people in this world that will, be convinced because of me.
Sharing homegrown produce with neighbors or friends who've never eaten anything that hasn't come from the store, that can often be a transformative experience. They realize, oh my God, that it can be so much better than what I'm used to.
That's true.
So, what is your final message to people who are thinking of getting into growing more of their own food and breeding crops?
I think the main thing is just I would just try to keep an open mind about the possibilities. Try not to get discouraged because there's a lot of information out there that will tell you don't have enough land or you're not saving enough seeds from enough fruit. Or you're not doing it the right way, or you have to read five different technical manuals to understand what you need to do. Try to just keep things simple. It really is, people's been breeding crops for thousands of years and most of them didn't know anything about how to read or write. And they were a lot simpler than you or I. They knew less than we knew in terms of, education. And they did just fine, you know. Just try to keep things simple and just do what makes you happy.
There's no substitute for hands-on experience, I find. Like you get to know a feel for a particular crop. Like you can just look at a patch of soil or feel the weather, and based on past experience, you'll know whether it's right for that crop.
Right, yeah, there's an intuition that matters a whole lot, so.
And yeah, no amount of studying and reading books can substitute for that. So you just got to get out there and get your hands on it.
Exactly. Yeah, experience is the best teacher, and a lot of times education will bring out ideas that you could have taken you 10 years to figure out on your own. So it's almost like a shortcut. But also I think there's a possibility of being educated for your experience level. Like try to if you're so much more educated than your experience level, then it's just it's not productive. So I think the main thing is get as much experience as you possibly can and supplement that with education.
Brilliant. Now, final end plug opportunity. If people want to learn more about what you're doing or get in touch, what's the best place that they can find you?
I would say the best place is the going to see community. I try to send people that way, and Joseph Lofthouse and that community has been influential to me and responsible for what I do. So in terms of getting me started, so anytime I can get somebody on that website and participate in that community, I'd love to support that.
Brilliant. I've really loved watching your regular posts updating about what you're doing.
I appreciate it. I loved it. That's the reason why I do it, because I love to do it. I love to share what I'm doing.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thank you very much, Austin, for taking the time to talk to us, and we'll maybe check in again in a few years' time.
Okay, sounds good. Appreciate it.